Hey everybody, I'm Ray. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Here's my $2, all right? Because I'm a compulsive gambler. So I'll give you 3-1. I get that back. All right. You know how I found out I was speaking here tonight? It was through an email. Chris sends this email out, and Ray C. is speaking March 17th. I go, oh, all right. You know, I find out a lot of times through emails that Chris sends out that I'm speaking somewhere. And it's, you know, for those of you who don't know, Chris is my sponsor, and he literally saved my life. It did. I don't say that with any reservations at all. I was coming to meetings and I was relapsing, and just happened to come. I moved up around this area and I was sharing in a meeting, and this woman walks up to me and says, "You should talk to him over there. He works with guys like you, you know?" And so I walked up to him. I was, "What's going on?" And he took me to his house when no one else, they didn't even want to talk to me. They pretty much wrote me off. I was going to meetings and I'd raise my hand, coming back. Anybody here ever relapse? Yeah, me too. Yeah. I relapsed 2,000 times, I guess, somewhere around there. And by the way, just because I relapsed doesn't mean I changed my clean date. All right? My sobriety date doesn't necessarily have to change. All right? That's how sick I am. I've collected coins while taking drugs. I'm not drinking. All right? To qualify, listen, I remember I'm about 13 years old. I drank 3 Michelobes on the corner. It was 2 corners away from my house. I grew up in Union. And from that day on, everything that I ever wanted to be, whether it be sports or anything that I ever wanted to attain, it was gone. It went away. I don't know if I had an obsession an obsession of the mind, but it certainly was. It was a problem. I was thinking about it a lot. All right, and I would start drinking on weekends, and you know, I don't want to offend anyone, but I did a lot of drugs as well. And you know, out of respect for AA, I'll keep it down on the drugs. But I'm an addict, and that's just the way it is. God made me an addict, so you can't blame me, right? I don't know about that. I don't know how true that is, by the way. Well, so what happened is I was drinking on the weekends, and I don't know when it happened, but it became an obsession of the mind. An obsession of the mind is defined as a thought that outweighs logic. Logically, I don't even know if I knew how wrong it was yet. I was young. I don't know if I knew if it was wrong. All I know is that I wanted to drink and I wanted to get high. I knew that. And it was like that for some time. I didn't start getting, you know, Chris asked me to tell some stories. I usually don't speak too much about what it was like. But I will say this. If I put alcohol in my body, I have no idea what's going to happen. All right? Blackouts. Maybe not blackouts. Maybe I stop. Maybe I stopped at 2 or 3, and certainly when I stop, I can't stay stopped. That is something that I never could really understand. That later on, early on, I was an animal early on, and after in 1982, I went to my first rehab, and it had nothing to do with me. I thought I was going to stop the hard drugs and still smoke pot and drink. That's what I thought rehabs did for you. And I come out of it and said, I got to stop everything. And I got about 5 years. I think, because like I said, I don't change my clean date when I use. I still take coins. You know, that's my MO. Well, anyway, when I was younger, I think I was about 13 or 14, I first got arrested for, I was smoking hash or something right outside the school. I got caught, got arrested. That's the first time I got in trouble with the law. And that became a regular thing. Nothing crazy. It was, a lot of vandalism. There could be fights. And then it progressed into some pretty serious stuff. And just by the grace of God, I'm not even going to go into what it was, but it was pretty serious. You know, my parents had to put their house up for bail. I remember one time my father says, well, let him stay there. As I was a juvenile still, let him stay there. He said, well, we're not calling you to get him this time because you can't. You know, that's, you know, the seriousness of it at that time. So they couldn't even get me. But what happened is I just became from someone who really just loved this and partied all the time to someone that was pathetic. I just wanted to stay at home. The party goes for me or went for me at some time. I don't know when that was, but I remember one time we were down the shore, and by the way, I couldn't keep a car. I don't know about you guys, but that's a side effect for me from alcoholism. I wasn't even given this car. First car, I think I had it a week, totaled it. Second car, not long. Third car, 10 hours. I remember my father one time saying to me, he didn't have much sympathy, my father. He was tough. And he ruled with an iron fist. He really did. He was a good man, good, honest man. I remember one time he said, you know, I actually feel sorry for you. And you have no idea how much that meant coming from my father. It's not something I heard too often from him. And I realized, you know what? I am really pathetic now that he actually feels sorry for me. You know, because he just never really felt sorry for me. I'm sure he felt it, but he certainly never said it. But I'm down the shore. So I've totaled every car that I had, my parents' cars, my girlfriend's cars, my girlfriend's girlfriend's cars, my friend's cars. I just couldn't drive when I was, I don't know, maybe it was a defect. That was a character defect. Chris brought that out of my fifth step, character defect. All right, so we're down the shore, and someone decides that they want to do a run for Valiums, I think it was, in the city. I says, I'll go. The guy trusts me. I've only totaled every single car I ever was in. And this girl comes with me. I don't remember who she was. She wasn't my girlfriend. She was just someone down there who takes the ride and we go. And then I go cop a big bag full of Valiums. And I figure, let me eat mine now. And by the time I get home, I'll be buzzed. And not thinking, because I didn't work too much, certainly back then, and I didn't commute, I hit rush hour. All right, so I'm at the Holland Tunnel, and I ate a lot, because I have everybody's. All right, so I ate a lot. And I bumped this guy in front of me. I'm in the line. It's at least a half an hour out of the tunnel. It's 4:30. I bump him. He turns around, I go, sorry. I fall asleep, bump him again. Sorry. I had to hit this man 100 times through the tunnel. And back then they had real bumpers, so I don't think anything was happening. He wasn't getting out of the car to check. I don't know what's going on. Nowadays, you're so arrested for something like that. I think, you know, falling asleep at the wheel is a crime or something, they said. I don't know. It was, you know, you didn't even need cup holders years ago. You know, you just put the beer right between your leg, drive, it was an art. And I remember one time a friend of mine takes me to, he's an attorney now, and he went to Fairleigh Dickinson, and he had all these new friends at Fairleigh Dickinson. Hey, Ray, come on, you want to come to a party with me? I go, yeah. So I bring a few people with me. And this house was, it was in Madison. It was a mansion. It was beautiful. So first off, my buddy falls through the skylight. I don't know how he manages that. So he's cuts himself and he's gone now. So that's the guy I brought with me. We managed to pull him up. He didn't fall all the way through, but he went through a lot. And we started playing quarters. Anybody play quarters? Anybody like playing quarters? I love quarters. And I'm playing quarters, I don't know, about an hour. I go downstairs into the basement. And now this is where I guess the drugs are, right? So this guy, he's got this bag of, I don't know, they look like they Quaaludes. I don't know if they were real or not. He goes, hey, you want any Quaaludes? I go, yeah. And he hands me the bag. I go, how many can I have? He says, as many as you want. These guys had money, I guess, you know. I took them all. Took the whole bag. Now I'm walking around, and there's somebody with mushrooms, right? The peyotes. And he says, you want some peyotes? I says, yeah. Hands me the bag. I says, how many can I have? He says, as many as you want. I eat them all. So now I got this cocktail, and I go up, I'm starting to play quarters again. Now I got this cocktail brewing in me, and I'm playing quarters. And I'm sitting there, and I know I'm going to puke. I just know it. And for some reason, the quarter games that I always was at, someone was going to puke. And this house was just gorgeous. And I remember I'm sitting there, and I got to puke, and I know I got to get to the bathroom. Well, I don't make it to the bathroom. I make it a half a step, and I'm just projectile vomiting all over this beautiful house. I mean, the carpet was just spectacular. And I'm running to the bathroom, and I'm throwing up everywhere. I get to the bathroom. I fill a beautiful double sink, by the way, they had in there. I fill up one sink, get to the next sink, fill up the next sink. I get to the toilet, and I just wipe my mouth. I go, And I just walk, go into some bedroom, you know, how the open houses were. I go into a bedroom, and I go to sleep. And the next day I wake up, and people are in a pool. I look outside, wow, there's a pool, you know? And I go into the pool with all my clothes. I have puke on me and everything. I just go into the thing, and obviously, my buddy never brought me back to too many parties at his friends from Madison anymore, or his college friends, let's just say that. But I ran into this, you know, I ran into this literally all the time. I would, did anyone here ever wake up with blood stuck to the pillow and not know why? You know, I did that so much. What's going on here? And it ripped the blood off. I says, oh, you know, must have fell, I guess. I don't know. One time I my brother comes into my room and my eye is swollen. And I asked him, who hit me with a bat? Because I'm figuring, I got to go get somebody. And I find out I fell, right? Fell. I was trying to fight somebody. And I was so whacked out. My buddy, he was my close friend. We used together. He wouldn't let me fight because I would have just got killed. So he said I ran away from him, ran into the woods, and then he heard a thump, you know. And they bring me to the hospital. Oh, but you know what? I gotta go make amends to a hospital. I was a different one, but I told the wrong name because I didn't have insurance. But he brings me to the hospital, And I don't remember any of this. I'm in a blackout. And he told me the guy was doing such a good job on your eyes, sewing it up. And then you suckered him. You just punched the doctor right where he goes, you know, you're such a jerk off, he said. I said, I don't really remember, you know. But I think he did a pretty good job, you know, sewing the eye up. I don't really remember. What's that? So this went on and on, and I could go on. There's so many of these stories that are, I'll give you a for instance. I didn't make good decisions either. I remember I'm with this old time junkie, and I'm a kid, maybe 17, 18, and we're pretty, plastered. And I'm driving around. It was the front seat, where, you know, it's a bench front seat. I'm in the middle. The guy that I was friends with was on the right, and this guy that I never even met before is on the left. And we're riding around. I don't know what we're doing. Well, what we're doing is we're stalking his ex-wife or his ex-girlfriend. I didn't know this. Yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm driving along. Seatbelts were an option back then, you know. So, drinking and driving was legal, I guess. I don't know. So, all of a sudden we're on the side of the road. And his gun comes through the window in front of my face, and it's his ex, whatever. She's holding this gun at this guy, and I'm looking right, and that's when I know. I guess he's stalking her. I figured that one out, and I'm looking at her. I go, she's kind of hot, you know. I get her number, and I figure she's okay. I mean, that's the kind of decisions that I made, you know. They weren't based on, sanity, let's just say. And what happened to me is there was, when I first went into the rehab, I didn't have any huge law, any law troubles at the time. I didn't have anything, you know. I did have hepatitis, and I was sick, but it was really the grace of God that got me into that rehab. My friend, the guy who would not let me fight that person. I got a whole California story too. We moved out to California for a year. Oh my God. I don't know. Anybody says, oh, how's the water? I don't know how the water is. I never went in the water. Are you supposed to go in the water? California? I don't know. We found the bad element. That's what we did in California. And we had a motorcycle. I remember, oh my God. We worked for this company that it was Dayon Corporation. I don't know if they're in existence anymore. It was a huge company. I believe it was out of Canada, and they were doing condo conversions. And we were just pure laborers, and then they had us do carpentry and framing. But they would give us a place to stay while we were there, and they also gave us as much beer as we wanted to drink after work. So I remember everybody complaining because we were drinking so much. The two guys from Jersey were drinking everything. And I would drink a case. They had a lot of beer in there. I would drink a case a night. So they're saying, slow down. How much you drink? I go, drink faster. What do you mean slow down? I'm not slowing down. Kidding me? So we're every night, the both of us, at least a case, God knows what else we were doing. If it was amphetamines, we were probably okay to drive. Is that right?
Yeah.
And if we're okay. And if it was something else, we're worse. But just a case of beer in itself. And that's when I first found out about the bumps in the road. Because we had one motorcycle between us. We had no car. Couldn't afford a car. And because the bumps would wake us up, you know, when we're, you know, it was a long day. You know, start early in the morning, 5 in the morning, you know, I guess 3, 4 o'clock, and then start drinking. And if it wasn't for those bumps, you know, boom, 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 on a motorcycle, I would have definitely went off. I said, you know, these things are cool. And I remember them coming to Jersey later on. So they definitely saved my life. What happened though is my friend's sister was very influential in Rutgers. And she, was trying to get him into a rehab, and he wasn't going unless I was going to a rehab. So she got us both into a rehab. And I ended up in New Hope first. And I remember, detoxing with these old men snoring. I'm probably as old as those old men now snoring, but, and I'm looking, and it was just horrible. And that's where I first kind of heard that they were gonna, that you had to stop everything, you know. And they listened to my story and they said, you know what, you have far too much drugs in your history, right? We think you need long-term treatment. Now mind you, I have no law pending. I'm not forced here. Okay, I have nothing going on that I'm forced at this place. I says, long term? Like, what do you mean? This is our 18 months. I says, you got a phone? I says, yeah. Make a phone call. Ma, come on, get me out of here for 18 months. I'm not going 18 months anyway unless I was forced to stay. Well, what happened is they ended up getting me to another place that treated people who are alcoholic and addicts. And it was, Marworth. I went to Marworth. And that was like that place was beautiful compared to New Hope, compared to a lot of places. It was nice. And I remember doing a quick version of the steps. You know, there was a lot of other stuff going on other than the steps, but I remember, I had a lot of, anger toward my father. You know, parents just never get away. Every time I take somebody through to work, it's the parents. I go, I don't hate anyone. You gotta hate your mother and father. Everybody hates their mother and father. Even if you didn't know your mother and father, you gotta hate your mother and father. You kidding me? Oh yeah, alright. And you know, my father was, you know, he was tough, but he was a good man. And, you know, he went to work. He didn't cheat on my mother. He was an honest man. So I was unable to look at the good qualities of this man. I only looked at the bad qualities. And it's just so easy, even in the relationships that I have today. It's just so easy for me to focus on the bad qualities of someone rather than the good qualities. I mean, that's just what I do. And I need, you know, 900 hours of meetings and churches just to get close to where these other people are walking around every day. And they're not like me. They, you know, I used to hear earth people years ago. Remember that term, earth people? And I used to get mad. I go, what are you, earth people? We're the same. You know what? I don't know about that anymore. I gotta tell you, aside from the physical craving that I have, with alcohol or drugs, my emotions, I just believe that emotionally, I got a lot of emotions going on, and they may be amplified, like the amplified version of the Bible. They're amplified. I just heard about this. What's an amplified version of the Bible? What is it, Jim? Louder? It's louder. So anyway, I get about 5 years, and I remember exactly what happened. I had some problem with a tooth, and suddenly came on me. You know, for anyone that doesn't know, suddenly, what's it on page? It's on page 24. Is it suddenly? It is one of my favorite parts of the book. No, that's not page. What's suddenly? Here it is on page 36. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. I don't know about you, but when I read that, I kind of agreed with the guy. Even now, it sounds, well, you know, he's got a full stomach, you know, and he's with milk, and it kind of makes sense. I understand. The experiment went so well, I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. I get that. I understand that. I had no choice. I didn't know it. I had no choice whether or not I took that pill, drink, or anything else. I thought I had a choice. But the truth is I have absolutely no choice whether or not I drink or not drink. And that's a pretty scary notion. You know, the first step is we're screwed. That's the first step in recovery. We're screwed. And the second step in recovery is maybe not. When Chris asked me in his house, do I believe that I could be restored to sanity? And the sanity they're speaking about is the insane thought that I can drink normally. And I said, this is what I was thinking was no, I'm thinking no. You know, I didn't think I could stop anymore. And the reason that I wanted to stop again was because now I had a little daughter, and she was about 2 months old, and I just felt that this kid did not deserve to have an alcoholic or a drug addict as a father. And that's what really, really made me want to stop. Yet I couldn't. Even, you know, and for those people who say, you have to stop for yourself, I don't believe that. I believe that I can stop for someone else. However, if I don't get to a point where I go through this work and I have a connection with God and I understand that there's a greater thing going on here for instance, I used to go to meetings because I need a meeting. Now if I go to a meeting, I'm looking for someone that might have to go through the work. It's a complete shift. And, you know, I was reading this book the other day, and I just wanted to read something out of it. Years ago, I read this book. It's How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Why? Because I wanted to influence people. I didn't necessarily want any more friends. And I wanted to make money. You know, I was younger, and I read it, and I never read this stuff. You know, I'm reading it again, and it says you can make. It says on page 42 in this book, it says if out of reading this book you get just one thing, an increased tendency to think always in terms of other people's point of view and see things from their angle. Well. I never read that, okay? Not certainly. And the more and more I read other books that I've read before, I see that. I just figured this is a book that's going to show me how to influence people and make money, and it will. You know, if someone didn't invent honesty for a way of getting rich, they should have, because that is that one of my amends with Chris was I was. Not necessarily a reputable businessman. And he said, you have to be a reputable businessman, an honest businessman. And that's a living amends. You know, there's a lot of amends that, you know, that I can't make, that I have to live them. What good is it if I'm taking people through this work and I continue the same behavior that I've continued my whole life. It's worthless. And besides, people watch what we do. They don't listen to us. I was reading this book not too long ago, and it said, the real you is the one you are at home. I said, oh. I'm a jerk. So, I mean, you know, I need to see these shots. You know, I need to understand the real me. What do you mean? That's what I am. Well, that's not good. It's not good. So, you know, I asked, first, you know, before you could do something about a problem, you got to be aware of the problem, you know, and I do believe that the real me is the one I am at home. I do believe that. What good is, I could be nice to a stranger, what do I care? Personal relationships are always at the root of our problem, right? Chris, it's easy if I'm living in a desert to get along with everybody. It's easy if I'm by myself at home alone with a TV set, I can get along with everybody. I got good sobriety. It's when I have to be involved with another human being is when the problem arises for me. All right. So I had to learn how to I had to learn how to live, and what happened is when I met Chris, he said, "Come on, let's go through the work." And I said, "All right." You know, I wanted to stop. I don't know about anyone here, but I remember doing 90 meetings in 90 days and starting 90 meetings in 90 days and not making it past too many days and going out and drinking. And other times I remember being on my knees asking God, please just make me want to stop. Forget about stopping. How about just want to stop? And other times I can remember being on my knees asking God, and halfway through I just get up off my knees. I go, what's the use? I'm going and drinking and getting high. And that's where I came from. I couldn't stop no matter what. And what happened was I was in the meetings and I had a spiritual malady, is what Chris told me I had. Me. I go, is that contagious? So, and the best definition is our bedevilments on page 52. It says we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. And we couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. So I walk into AA and I have done nothing. I'm going to do my 90 and 90. But yet, I'm having trouble with personal relationships. I can't control my emotions. I'm miserable. I'm depressed. I can't make a living. I feel useless. I'm full of fear. I'm unhappy, and I can't seem to be of help to anyone. That's why I drink. And they're telling me now, don't drink. I tell you what, I'm full of fear. I get a drink or a drug in my hand, and the fear goes away. That calmness is, I feel it before I even drink. All right? That's alcohol works for me. Alcohol works for my spiritual malady. And that's why I drank. And I never could understand that. I couldn't understand why after I stopped, why do I still want to use? Why do I still want to drink? And when Chris pointed this out, and I didn't tell you the truth, steps one, steps two, steps three, I don't really, you know, I remember Ron sharing that he didn't remember too much of 1, 2, and 3. And I got to tell you the truth, I don't really remember too much what Chris was telling me with 1, 2, and 3. What I do remember is when we did our fifth step, and by the way, Chris told me to write down all the people I hated. And by the way, I knew that one. That's the one thing I knew. I knew the people I hated, and I knew why. And the third column and fourth column when we did a fifth step, actually, while I was even writing it, I started to look at a lot of these resentments as pretty petty. But I had over 100. I hated. If I knew you, I hated you. You know, and what happened was when we did this fifth step, my thinking changed. I began to look at it like it says in the big book and even how Dale Carnegie wrote from a different angle. Whether it be the person that I had the resentment towards angle, whether it's God's angle, I don't know, it doesn't really matter what, but it was not my angle anymore. And it wasn't, what I was, it certainly, I was able to look at it, a quick example. I like to give examples. Was my neighbor. I don't know, you may have heard this story, but I was living in this house, and my neighbor was going to call the township that dirt was running off my property onto his property. And I'm thinking, and now I'm furious. You're going to what? You're going to call the township? Now this guy's back of his house was facing that back of my house. So there's a lot of things I could have done to him over the years, I'm thinking, right? That's the way I thought. I'll get him. If nothing more than just take his garbage can every night and throw it in the woods. You know, at least that. But, so I said, all right, you know what? I had gone through this work with Chris. You know, let me do this resentment. And I wrote this resentment out. And Bob, and why did I not like Bob? Bob was, he was going to, call the authorities on me. And what does that affect? It affects everything, but obviously, pocketbook, pride, and I would pray for Bob and the resentment prayer on page 67. And then, I would have to look at what my part was. And here's what my part was. I brought 100 tandems of dirt onto my property over the weekend because it was illegal. I knew it was illegal. If you bring more than two or three in that town, it changes the grade. That's why I did it over the weekend, because nobody was working, no town. I got trucks coming all weekend, beep, 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 coming back and forth. And then it was July and we had the most ferocious rainstorms for two weeks. And I'm reading this and I'm doing this resentment. I go, oh my God, I'm mad at him. What the heck did I do to this man? The mud just slid. He had beautifully manicured flowers and trees, and it was a riverbed. It was just silt. And I grab a shovel out of my garage. I run down there. I'm going to go dig this mud out, right? And I just sink to my knee. I go, oh no. And you know, I went back through the shovel in the garage. Went and knocked on Bob's door, made amends, and told him that I'm going to make it right, paid the landscaper, because obviously it was a little bit more than I could handle, sodded, which obviously cost a lot more money than seed, sodded what was there quickly so it wouldn't run off anymore onto his property, dug a ditch out. I made it right. And then when I saw Bob taking his daughter to school, because my daughter went to the same school that he was going to, I didn't have to either A, avoid him, or B, want to harm him, let's say. You know, it was one or the other for my whole life. And it was a very freeing thing. And that's how this process works. And by the way, if you have a resentment, oftentimes it leads to an amend. If you're going through the work the second time, please don't think about the amends. Because if you're like me, if I have a resentment, I'm going to start thinking, I'm going to make amends to this son of a, I don't really hate this guy. Yeah, I don't really have a resentment toward this guy. You know, it's not good. You know, if you have a resentment, is a resentment. I don't necessarily know if there's anything we could do about it. We could ask God to remove it, obviously, but there are. And the other thing is, please don't make amends without going over the amends with your sponsor or the person that's taking you through the work, because certainly there has been amends that have been messed up. I remember first amends before I tried this amends process without Chris's help on, and I remember I went up to this guy, I go, I don't like you. because it was in a retreat. This guy, I don't like you because you did this and you did this and this. What? And I'm looking, you know, now I look, I just out of my mind. That was my amends, all right? An amend is supposed to be where I look at what I did, and you know, go and apologize, go make amends, go try and make it right to somebody that you really hate, and go try and continue to hate on that person. It's very difficult. And a resentment is our number one offender. A resentment is what blocks me off from God faster than anything. And yeah, when I had 100 resentments, throw another one on, it really didn't matter. But now when I live without any resentments, one is too much. One is very dangerous. And it says we don't have the dubious luxury of normal men in this book. And it's not a luxury. That's why he writes dubious luxury. It's not a luxury. But we don't even have that dubious luxury, because being alcoholic, that is the number one offender. And I have seen a lot of people drink over resentments. Fears, obviously, are big. And one of my greatest fears was my daughter being hurt, either physically or emotionally. It was one of my biggest fears. And on 68, there's a fear prayer, and it goes like this. God, please remove my fear of my daughter being hurt and direct my attention to what you would have me be. Not what you'd have me do, what you'd have me be. So, well, he would have me trust in God. But does he think God wants me to sit around and worry what's going to happen to this child and probably transfer my fear over to this kid, be one of those overprotective parents? Or do you think he wants me to enjoy the time that I'm with her? And that was a life changer for me. I can enjoy the time that I am with my child. I don't have to sit in the future or sit in the past. I could be in the now. And that's, you want to talk about heaven. That's recovery. Being in the now is recovery. I was never able to be in the now. My head was always in the future. It's about something. And by the way, if you have money problems, money's probably not your problem. You know, I could not understand that one. You know, I read something that the number one fear for people with $5 million or more is money. That seemed a little odd to me, right? It's either fear of losing what we have or fear of not getting what we want. So what happened is, I think Chris took me through to work somewhere around 97, I guess. It was before the meeting was here, and before the clunker. Remember the clunker? There was a guy. Chris used to have the meeting at his house. Some guy comes in fresh out of prison, and I'm thinking, why is this guy in Chris's house? You know, and the guy was sharing a story about how he was clunking people with a hammer. Yeah, I would clunk them. This guy wouldn't get me what I wanted. I'd just clunk them. Yeah, clunk them. Clunk him. I go to Chris after the meeting. Chris, are you kidding? He goes, I didn't bring him here. Somebody just brought him here. I don't know. So the meeting kind of left his house, you know, and came over to here. Clunker. So anyway, Chris takes me through this work, and I have some pretty huge experiences. One of which was trusting in what Chris was telling me. And by the way, Chris never, after I went through this process, Chris was not one of the guys that told me to call him every day. As a matter of fact, he probably said, don't call me every day, you know. And he wanted me to become dependent upon God, not him. And I love that about him. Chris is always there. If I call him, he returns my phone calls. But he never tried to take credit, and he never tried to have an ego to where he said he was, in charge. He always told me, I was having some difficulties and some family difficulties. And he said, Ray, I can't tell you what to do. He says, you pray, you meditate, you've done this work, and the answer will come. And I mean, I love this man for telling me that and not telling me, oh, you gotta stay, or you gotta leave, or you have to do this. It is not my place to tell anybody what the heck to do in a relationship, especially with my past relationships, okay? Even if I had it all right, who am I to tell somebody you should stay in that relationship? Obviously, if somebody's getting hurt in a relationship, that's a different story. But for me to say, you should leave her, you should leave him, why don't you just look at my past track record and we'll go from there and see if you want to take my advice on anything. What I could do is I could get you to God and you could make your own decision. And that's what Chris did. And I was okay with the amends part, by the way. I was okay with saying I'm sorry. But now it came to the point where I'd actually start paying some money back, and I had a huge, huge problem. It didn't make sense to me. I may have stole something. I already got away with it. Why am I going to pay this money back? Right? I don't know. That's how I thought. So now I'm thinking, I can't stop no matter what. This is what I'm thinking. I got to take his word for it. And I put my faith in what he was telling me. And it was a real turning point for me. And my first money amends was this lawnmower that I stole from a church years ago. And I went, and not only did he want the money, he wanted me to write a letter that he could read, in church to all his parishioners. And I did. I'm just thankful that I didn't get the riding one started, because I tried to get the riding one started. I remember I took it and I went through these woods with it so I didn't get caught, and I came through my buddy's house and there's his mother looking, and I'm got like sticker bushes on me, I'm coming up with this brand new lawnmower. She goes, oh my God, where'd you get that? I go, I found it. I gotta keep, open your garage up though. I gotta keep it here for a little while. And, I knew some, guys, I knew some people that were landscapers and also sold drugs. So it was kind of convenient, I knew this, you could steal land, you could steal lawnmowers and get rid of them. But, what I did is I paid this money back, and it was a big turning point in my life. And then I started paying everybody back. And I made amends for all the cars I stole, cars I totaled, I made amends for all of them. One person wouldn't take the money, and I knew that she was, in hard times. And she was a single parent. And I asked, I used to brag about a lot of my harms. I don't know about you, but they were funny, I did this. Well, when you go eye to eye, face to face with the people that you cause these harms to, it gives a whole nother angle at what you did, or what I did. And this particular car that I smashed was her graduation present from her father, and something happened where she couldn't go to school, or it really messed her up, so I called Chris and I said, listen, I don't want to offend her, but I want to give her the money, and I know she could use it. So he had me write a letter saying, for my recovery, I need you to accept this. And that was, it was brilliant, what happened was I wasn't taking anyone through to work, and I'm going to tell you, I was nervous. I felt like I didn't know what to say. All right. On top of that, I was selfish and self-centered, and I'd rather kind of be home. Good football game on. So long story short, I ended up getting this melanoma on my stomach. And I was reading this book at the time, Glenn Clark. If anyone hasn't read Glenn Clark books, the early AA guys all read Glenn Clark. And he talked about this guy who was asking help from God, and it dawned on him that you're asking help and you've never done anything for him. And who are you to ask? I said, and I'm reading that right now, you know, and they're pulling lymph nodes out of me. They don't know if I'm going to live or die. I said, all right, God, I'll work with others, you know, and I just started taking people through to work. And out of laziness, I would take people through to work fast. I didn't want to meet them a lot of different times. I wanted to get it over with. And what I found is people were recovering and they were staying sober. And the success rate, going through the work really fast was pleased with it, you know. And there was a few pivotal points, areas where you could lose someone. It's on the fifth step, which, by the way, Chris told me we're going to meet on Sunday to do my fifth step. I didn't write anything. This was like on Friday. You know, so Saturday night, I'm writing my fourth step all out because I wasn't good. If he didn't tell me we're meeting to do a fifth step, I still haven't done my fifth step. All right, so if you're taking someone through the work, make an appointment with them right there to do the fifth step. Because if they're like me, and by the way, if you don't have a newcomer to work with, after the meeting, go in front of the door because that's where they're going to be. They're going to be out of the door first. Newcomers are always flying for the door. That's what I did. A newcomer, relapser, I was out of the door. So what happened was I was taking a lot of people through to work. And on page 13, Bill W. Talks about his experience. And he was up to his ninth, didn't have 12 steps at the time, but he was up to his eighth step list. In one afternoon, he was out making amends. Now, I've heard a step a year. I've heard take it easy. I've heard so many different things. But my belief is, if it's not in this book, thank God they wrote it down. If it's not in this book, I can question it. I could start to question it. And I don't see anywhere in this book where it says to wait. On page 13, is Bill, a co-founder of every single, you know, of AA and every other single 12-step program in the world only. I mean, that's what he is. He went through in an afternoon. He was up to his amends in an afternoon. On page 129, on the family afterwards, it says here that, though the family does not fully agree with Dad's spiritual activities, they should let him have his head, even if he displays a certain amount of neglect and irresponsibility towards the family. It is well to let him go as far as he likes in helping other alcoholics. During those first few days of convalescence, this will do more to ensure sobriety than anything else. They had guys working with people when they had days sober. And in a chapter to the employer, in his first months, he can help other people days, months. I don't see years here. I see an afternoon, I see days, I see months, but I see people, the message I see, Bill talks about it, if sex is very troublesome, throw yourself harder into working with others. Nothing so much ensures immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. He meant taking people through this work. And he certainly didn't, I mean, maybe I'm reading it wrong, but he certainly didn't mean wait. You know, we have a grace period. And Chris told me this. He goes, right now you're under God's grace. We don't know how long it's going to last. Maybe a couple weeks, but we should do this fast. And that's how I look at it. When someone wants to go through the work, or if there's somebody new, if there's somebody who wants to go through the work, I don't wait because I don't know how long his grace period is. I just try and do it like they did in AA years ago. And I'm just really thankful. I'm lucky. I know it's the grace of God that I ran into Chris. But you know, I'm just really fortunate. You know, I was heard not in AA. There was a speaker say that how many people believe that everything happens for a reason, and the whole room raised their hands. And then he said, if you could go back and change one thing, would you do it? And a lot of people raised their hands. Well, you can't have it both ways. You know, you either believe that your circumstances, all our circumstances, got us all right here, right now, in this room. We're at sum total of everything that happened to us. And I don't, you know, I don't look at things as good or bad. You know, me getting sick got me closer to God and got me to work with others. If I have too much money, too many things, I get disconnected from God. So I don't know what's good and what's bad. I do know that meetings, steps, and service are essential for my recovery. And that you know, if you're talking about God and the steps, people are going to listen because that's what recovery is about. Thanks for letting me share.